Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At El Verno this Saturday, a fascinating conference. The title is Are We There Yet? And one of the panel discussions will feature two female journalists who are differences in ages, but are confronting some of the same problems that women faced in journalism many years ago. The first panel is titled Are We There Yet? And it will feature women who worked at Newsweek 40 years apart. And those women are our guests the first half hour of our program today. Later this hour, we'll talk about the Peace Learning Center in Milwaukee, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary. They help fourth and fifth graders focus on conflict resolution. Heavens knows the world could use a little more of that. Both shows will be welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Two guests with us, Lynn Povich is editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine and managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She was the first woman editor of Newsweek, and she has a new fascinating book that is titled The Good Girls Revolt: How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. And Lynn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say I was the first senior editor, not editor of the magazine.
All right, and that makes a difference, too, the first senior editor. Also joining us is Jessie Ellison. She's a staff writer and articles editor at Newsweek and also the Daily Beast. Jessie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lynn, let's start with you. I think it's interesting that you're a highly educated woman, but you started your job as a secretary at Newsweek, didn't you?
I did, as did many women of the late 50s and early 60s. Those were the jobs that were open to us when the help wanted ads were help wanted male and help wanted female.
And what year was that?
That was 1965.
It wasn't that long ago. It is remarkable. I know women face a lot of problems, but think about that here you are. You were a woman who was very highly educated. You should have walked in and become a writer.
Well, a few magazines, Businessweek, for example, did hire women right out of college as writers. But the news magazines, Time and Newsweek, started women actually on the mail desk and then clipped newspapers. And then, finally, you became a researcher or fact-checker. As you know, newspapers always had women writing for them, but at that time, even they were segregated in what was called the women's pages.
Right. Yeah. There was affirmative action that took place shortly thereafter that moved more women into many fields in broadcasting that were just completely off-limits to them. You just never saw women. You never heard women.
Yes, I think once the FCC required that a station's license be predicated on diversity, it certainly opened the doors to women and blacks.
Jessie, did you have to start as a secretary?
No, I did not. I did start as an intern, though, which is how many people start at this magazine now. Men and women, I should say.
And sometimes it's very long internships, too,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes, extended stretches of unpaid labor. Yes,
right. The thing that there are a lot of things that are appalling about this, but it's just amazing to me how much of this hanging by the desk, you know, this older guy who's got this lust for the young female reporter, the young female writer, the comments that are made in the newsroom that make it a really difficult place in which to work, that is still prevalent. You would think that we would be so far beyond that, Lynn.
I know. you would think, but I don't know that the overt sexism that existed at Newsweek, where women were all researchers and couldn't get promoted, can exist anymore. But certainly the culture is sort of rife with the kind of, many cultures are, with the kind of sexist remarks or pressures put on women, I think.
Jessie, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, part of what's so great about working in journalism is it's so collegial and friendly, and, you know, you're sort of in the trenches together sometimes. And but yes, it has downsides, and lines can be crossed. And I think really it has to do more with you know, when the structure is still so imbalanced, meaning like the top of an organization is still so dominated by men, that's when it gets really troublesome. You know, when there's actual equality, meaning there are women and men at all levels, I think that it's not as potentially dangerous, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Please remind us, Lynn, this was a very brave thing for people to do, of what caused the reasons for the suit against Newsweek and how it all came about. Who banded together, the Dollies who banded together to take on the company?
Well, as I said, the women, all of us were basically researchers and couldn't get out of our category or get promoted, even though several of them had been writing either for college papers or for other newspapers as freelancers. But it was when one of the women, Judy Gingold, was told by a lawyer that these segregated functions by gender were actually illegal, according to this 1964 Civil Rights Act, that she realized, you know, we have to do something about it. You know, she didn't realize it's illegal. When she said to the Equal Employment Opportunities person, well, maybe we should tell the men, I don't think they know it's illegal, the woman said, don't be crazy. They won't give up their power. You know, your case is so blatant that you really should do something. And so one by one, she started talking to her friends. I was the fifth one to join, and we started talking to all of the other researchers one by one about organizing and doing something about it.
Were you afraid to do this?
You know, we were so young. You know, most of us were sort of mid-20s. We felt we had nothing to lose. We luckily had the women's movement behind our backs. We were all getting excited about, I was covering the women's movement. We were reading about it, you know, and we suddenly realized it's not just about women. It's about us. I mean, this affects us at our jobs. So, you know, we didn't think about the fear as much at that moment.
Well, it's amazing when you look at some of these names like yours, people who were told that they could hope for positions as fact checkers and researchers, but nothing more. Nora Ephron, Jane Bryant Quinn, Ellen Goodman, Susan Brownmiller, for heaven's sake. Isn't that something?
They were the smart ones. They were hired and as researchers, too, and looked around Newsweek and realized they would never be promoted to writers, and so they actually left fairly quickly to develop, what you said, very successful careers. That's why we were the good girls. You know, we stayed, you know, did our jobs, and until we didn't, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then, as this is going on, Newsweek ran a cover story about the feminist movement, and they hired somebody who was outside of Newsweek to write this story.
Yes, because they had no women writers at Newsweek. I was a junior writer and really not experienced enough to do a cover story. The women's movement was newsworthy. They felt they should do a cover. They were smart enough to know they couldn't have a man write the cover. And so they hired a freelance journalist who worked at the New York Post, a very good writer, to come in and write the story. And that's when we decided that we would announce our lawsuit, because we knew the publicity would shame the editors far more than the discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Publicity has a tendency to do that, doesn't it? Yeah. Jesse, are things a whole lot better for you in the workplace now?
Well, I mean, I have to say that, we did an article about Lynn's lawsuit in 2010, and shortly thereafter, the magazine was sold and then merged, and we now have a female editor for the first time, Tina Brown. So, yes, I mean, it's a radically different place for all kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I think some of what we were feeling and what we wrote about in 2010 has definitely dissipated. But part of that was just the experience of writing it and learning. We didn't know this history at the time, and we were sort of stunned to learn that this had happened here, and that it hadn't, you know, remained a part of sort of institutional lore. So, and the process of meeting Lynn and meeting some of the other women involved and just understanding what had happened and also realizing just how relatively recently it all was actually very empowering for
mm-hmm.
all of us. So it really changed, I think, our experiences and how we felt here.
So, Lynn, was that one of the reasons, the motivating forces for writing your book, that people like Jesse didn't know the history of this?
Well, I did. I started way before I met Jesse and the other young women there. But Yes, I started writing just a narrative of what we did for the Radcliffe Library had requested our papers, and then I realized in the course of interviewing everyone again to really be accurate about what happened and how we did it that, you know, this was really a story that should be told, and I didn't even realize how lost it was. I knew that a lot of people didn't realize Newsweek was the first to sue in the media, the women at Newsweek. Everyone sort of hears about the New York Times suit because it's so important, too. They used our lawyer, in fact, because of our suit. And so I was afraid that the story would be lost. And then when I met Jessie and her colleagues, I had already been sort of reporting and writing the book.
The other thing that you point attention to, Jessie, and that's the pay differences here. Women who are highly educated are still making so much less to the dollar than male counterparts are. And even when you take into regard the, well, women drop out of the workforce, they go and have children, you can't count on them to have long careers. This happens very early before women even have children.
It does. It's pretty astounding. And that's, I mean, that's way outside of Newsweek, too. I mean, it's a much bigger problem.
Right.
And, yeah, there was a study of MBA graduates where they make several thousand less in their first job out of MBA programs. And I think there's a lot to do with it. I know that one significant issue is that women are way less likely to negotiate that first salary. So I actually heard last night a reference to I think 7% of women negotiate that first salary as opposed to 57% of men. So that sort of instantly they have this bump, and then that just, of course, piles on itself over the course of a career.
And what's the problem with the negotiation for women?
Well, I mean, it's very complicated. I think a lot has to do with our conditioning. Women, you know, and girls sort of grow up getting these messages that you shouldn't be too pushy, you shouldn't ask for too much, and, you know, you don't want to be perceived as demanding.
Yes.
And all these things. So, you know, we're trying to kind of not make anybody mad, I think, and still be good girls, really, is what it comes down to.
And it's not just entry-level jobs either, or your first job. I was talking to a news executive the other day, and he said, you know, in my 25 years of running two big organizations, only two women have ever come in to ask me for a raise.
No.
Yes.
He
said, guys come in all the time, many times, but women, very few women have actually asked.
How did you respond to Jessie's comment that we don't want to make anybody mad? What happened with the suit? Did you make a lot of people mad, and did people feel badly that they made people mad?
Yes. I mean, I think that we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, somebody said it was like the man named Nachshon in the Bible who was the first to put his foot into the Red Sea without knowing it was going to part. So we sort of did this, and then, you know, we knew we were protected legally from getting fired, but we had no idea what the response was going to be afterwards. And, you know, for the most part, the men we worked with, the writers and the reporters, were very supportive. Like many organizations, a lot of the discrimination came in middle management. For us, that was the senior editors and some of the top editors. One of the top editors we heard said, you know, why don't we just fire them all? So it depended. I mean, there were a lot of men who were on our side, but there were many men who were, A, against affirmative action of any sort, whether it was women or blacks, and B, just thought, you know, they are the lowest in the category, so we don't need them.
It's interesting, this conference is Are We There Yet? I'm old enough to have started in this field many, many years ago. I've been doing radio for 38 years now, 39 years. And it was a whole different world, let me tell you, for us back in those years as well. But when I look at that question and try to answer it, I say, well, yeah, there are a lot of women who work here now, and it's terrific. But I think about all that women have had to take on in all of those years, and it's huge, isn't it? And Lynn, let's start with you, because I know you have children, and you're working full-time, and you've got children to take care of, and you've got, you know, kids who are up late at night and all these extracurricular things and school to be attentive to and a job that is very demanding on a daily basis. Are we there yet? I don't know. We're everywhere, aren't we? I mean, we're kind of beat.
Yeah. I mean, women are doing, I mean, the thing about the U.S. with as being the only, you know, highly industrialized country without any public or private supports for daycare is that people sort of muddle through and
yes,
cobble
yes.
up whatever they can manage to help take care of the kids while two people are working and in our business at very sort of unpredictable kinds of jobs with a lot of pressure. So it is a real squeeze for people, and I think that one of the issues for all of us is, you know, making companies more flexible for working parents, you know, getting, again, some legislation which actually had been passed in Congress in the early 70s for accessible, affordable child care, which Nixon vetoed. But there's a real crunch for people who have full-time jobs and kids.
If you want to join our conversation, feel free to do so. The number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is part of a large conference that should be just fascinating at Alverna College. The Veteran Feminists of America are hosting a conference, Empowering Women, A Tale of Two Generations. And our guests this part of the show are going to be on a panel. They're of two generations. They're both journalists. Lynn Povich is editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine, and she is the author of a book about the women who sued Newsweek what year was it, Lynn?
1970.
Thank you, 1970. The book is The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. Jesse Ellison is also with us, staff writer and articles editor at Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Let me ask you, because it is so significant a part of women's lives and everybody's lives, that we do give birth and have pregnancy and all of that. What about young women at Newsweek and The Daily Beast and in your field dealing with that issue now? Jesse, is it still hard?
I'm sure it's still hard. I don't have kids myself. I'm sure it's still hard. I feel like I can't really speak to it directly because it's not part of my experience.
Right.
But, I can't imagine. It's a taxing, all-consuming sometimes job, and I can't imagine having to do both and do it well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how. I mean, that's certainly one of the outstanding big questions and issues because it's unavoidable.
Yeah, we haven't dealt with it. You're right. I would have thought by now, Lynn, that we would have had daycare centers or companies getting together because it makes people happy. It makes their lives so much easier, and women are over half the workforce now. So,
I know. I was talking with Gail Collins in the New York Times about this, about why there hasn't been any more legislation, at least, to, you know, as the Family Leave Act, I guess, is the sort of closest when you have a child need to take care of a parent, but it doesn't do it for, you know, just general child care. And she said it's because people will see it as an entitlement, and they're not going to reintroduce legislation because of that.
Yeah. Let's go to a couple phone calls. Monica in Milwaukee. Hi, Monica. Monica, are you there?
Is this Monica? Are you asking for me?
Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm calling because I'd like to just comment on the earlier comment that women don't ask for raises until they start at a lower starting point, and that affects their career. I've read subsequent studies and they have said there's a real good reason why women don't do that, and that's because after they do that, A, they don't get their raises, and B, there's repercussions for that. The other women see them as aggressive, the employer and the employee see them as aggressive and bitchy and, you know, asking too much, and there's huge repercussions for it. And then the other women see what happens when you try to do that. So, you know, again, we tend to blame the woman, you know, culturally, that she's been raised not to ask for this, that we don't do enough, but yet the women who do more are treated this way. So I think it's really culturally how the men in power behave when, and the work environment behaves when the woman does ask for more. So, you know, that's my comment. There's been subsequent studies talking about it.
Thanks for the call. Lynn, you want to take that?
Jesse, go ahead.
Monica, I'm very glad that you pointed that out, and I should have mentioned that earlier. It's true. There was one city I know that, you know, women who did try to negotiate that first salary were actually less likely to get hired. And it does seem like kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I think one thing that has come up as a possible or something that could help this going forward is to be really open about salaries, so that it's not, you know, a lot of workplaces have, you can't tell anybody what you make and nobody can talk about it, and it's all very secretive. But, you know, if there's some transparency there, it can help mitigate any kind of discriminatory practices that are going on, and remove, I think, some of those associations that come with you know, asking for raises and asking for what you deserve.
Lynn?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know about that study. And I just find that to be talking about pay inequity, there's just no excuse why somebody should be paid lower for, you know, the same job. And if people are then going to be punished for that, it just seems to me it's so clearly discrimination. And the fact that women are actually punished for, you know, asking for raises or wanting to negotiate their first salary seems to me something that should be sort of called out. And as Jesse said, whether it's by divulging salaries or, you know, discussing it in general, so that HR people or bosses know that they can't do this in some way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Monica, very much for the call. So I guess the final question before we see you in Milwaukee on Saturday, the title of the conference, Jesse, are we there yet?
Oh, gosh. No. Sorry. Unfortunately. But we're getting there.
Lynn, are we there yet?
Well, you know, I always say, like the civil rights movement, the women's movement hasn't solved anything. Everything. Would we say this about the civil rights movement? Would you say to an African American, are we there yet? I mean, No, of course not. Jesse's right.
Yeah. Well, it should be a fascinating conference, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
I would imagine. It's really a good idea. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
For having us.
Our guest will be speaking at Alverno at what should be a really interesting conference, Empowering Women, A Tale of Two Generations. Are we there yet? It's Saturday, September 15 at Alverno College, and they'll be speaking at the morning conference. They're on the first panel discussion. They have an interesting generational perspective. Lynn is editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine and managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. Her new book is The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. This was back in 1970. Jessa Ellison is a staff writer and articles editor at Newsweek and also at The Daily Beast. We thank them for being with us. More information about the conference on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we continue our conversation this Thursday. Peace Learning Center is celebrating its 10th anniversary this week. It was organized in, of course, 2002, and it has worked with well over 6,000, almost 7,000 young people who are in 4th and 5th grade, although they're expanding to middle school this year. The young people from schools in this area learn nonviolent conflict resolution, healthy communication, and also an appreciation of the natural world world through these Peacemaker workshops. This year, they're working with UWM student teachers and getting in on a ground level of training for these teachers. It's really an interesting program and a meaningful program in this time when we have to deal with conflict all over the world and in our schools and in our neighborhoods. Why not learn some of these tools? Joining us this hour is Tara Sarabin, who's Executive Director of Peace Learning Center of Milwaukee, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for her as we carry on. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and you can also leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hi, Tara. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What was the reason that this whole program started? Was there something that happened in the community, or were you just concerned about violence generally? What was it?
I believe I was not there at the initial beginning of Peace Learning Center, but there was a group of people who are very concerned about what they were seeing happening in their neighborhood. They were specifically from the River West neighborhood, but they were concerned about River West and Milwaukee in general, and looking what was happening with the young people. Looking, you know, it's in the news all the time. And they decided that they really wanted to get together and come up with a way to address those concerns. And they heard about a program that was going on in Indianapolis, Peace Learning Center of Indianapolis. They took a trip down. They saw what they were doing there. We also had, at that point, Ian Harris, who was part of UWM's peace organization. And he was one of the founding members of Peace Learning Center, along with Don Austin, Phyllis Berenstain, and a host of other people who got together and really sat down and worked on putting together a day-long workshop curriculum. They piloted it in 2002, one school, five classes at that time. From there, we have grown. This past year, we served well over 1,000 students. We had 43 separate workshops. We've been in 52 different schools throughout the Milwaukee area, and even last year, we went as far as Bondiwell, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah. So
you bring students to a natural setting, if you can, and what happens during the course of a day?
So ideally, we bring students. We are very, very fortunate to be able to host our workshops at the Quaker Meeting House, which is in River West.
And it's happens, lovely.
Oh, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. If you haven't been there, it sits right next to and kind of on a nature preserve along the Milwaukee River. So it's almost like a little island in the city. And kids are able to, during the day, they're looking out these huge windows that look at this, you know, beautiful setting outside. At the end of the day, we actually take them out and go on a hike. So they come to us for the day. And ideally, we get them as early as we can in the morning. Usually they arrive sometime between 8:30 and 10, depending upon school bus schedules and things. When they come to the workshop, the first thing we do is we greet them at the door with a big smile. We greet everybody. And, you know, that seems simple, but it's really an important way for us to start. We make eye contact with kids and make sure that they understand that we really are excited that they're there. And so we're starting off on a really positive note. Building community is a huge part of what we do. And so that's how we start off all of our workshops. We have a series of games that we play. They start from just introductory games. Kids are coming as a classroom so that they know each other to some extent, but the introductory games that we play, they get to learn something about each other that they didn't know before.
Hmm.
And so that's part of what we debrief with them is, what did you learn that
mm-hmm.
you didn't already
mm-hmm.
know? And connections that they can make with each other that they weren't aware that they had before. So it's a huge part of what we do to try and build those connections and strengthen the connections that they already have, because we really want them to begin to have a common language and to have this. These are people that they're going to be with for 7-8 hours a day all school year. So they really need to be able to work well with everyone, whether or not they're going to be their best friend. And, you know, there's a lot of research out there that says that the more invested you are in relationships with the people that you're with, the more willing you're going to be to compromise, to come up with solutions to problems. So we spend a lot of time doing that. So after the introduction time, then we begin with our cooperative games. And so we present them with a series of challenges in that they have to overcome together, either in small groups. That we start in small groups, and eventually we get so that the entire class is having to solve this challenge on their own. together. We ask that teachers, and this is really hard for teachers, teachers are along there with them, and we ask the teachers to kind of step back and let the kids take the lead. We really want them bringing out their leadership skills, and we really want them feeling empowered to solve their problems on their own. And so that sometimes can be a little tricky for teachers.
I'm sure it is for teachers.
I was a teacher before, so I know. And sometimes, you know, it's hard too for adults, because sometimes they can look at a problem and they can see, oh, well, if they just do X, Y, Z, they'll be done. And that's not what we want. We really want them to work through it. So as frustrating as it can be sometimes, the end result is just amazing. The kids just feel so good about themselves. So that's a good portion of the, you know, that's our very beginning. That's our foundation. Then we move on to talk about how important each individual is to the dynamic in the group. We have something that we do called how many people does it take? And we actually have one of our facilitators will leave the room to look for something and come storming back in the room and just slam a door or slap the wall and really yell at one of the other facilitators. And it takes everyone by surprise. In fact, the very first workshop that I ever facilitated, I hadn't been warned, and I was the person who got yelled at.
Oh.
Now imagine how I felt at that point. So it's a really effective way for kids to see that one person's action. So once that person leaves, they come back in and come in a different way. And then we talk with the kids. How did you feel? And to a person, they will say, I was scared, I was nervous, I was worried for him, I was, you know, uh-huh. They all feel it. And then we point out, but you know, he wasn't talking to you. He was really only talking to this other person. And yet, now, so you see the effect that one person can have on the whole group. And that's really eye-opening for, I do it even with adults when I do conferences with adults, and it's really eye-opening for people. They don't realize just how much effect one person can have. Once we've kind of established that, talked with them a little bit about it, we move into talking about peace mentors. And we have peace mentors that we have their posters up. And we talk about Cesar Chavez, Mother Teresa, Val Phillips, and I'm sorry, we also have Martin Luther King's poster
Martin
up
Luther
all
King.
The time, although he's not one of the ones that we talk about. And for some reason, I've lost my memory here. I'm sorry.
And are the students familiar with those peacemakers, or are they learning about them?
You know, it's interesting. To some of them they're familiar with, and some of them they're not. So we will divide them into small groups, and each group studies about one of them in a little more detail, and then they come back and they present to the rest of the group what they learned. Hmm. And so we are talking with them then about ways that big groups of people can solve really big problems nonviolently. So we talk a little bit about marches, and we talk a little bit about unions and strikes and petitions and rallies and things that they themselves might even find themselves getting involved in if they have an issue that they want to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So that is our peace mentor portion. After that, we usually take a break, and then we'll start to talk more specifically about feelings. We find that when kids come, they think of three feelings, and most of them, when you talk about feelings, they can say happy, they can say sad, and they can say angry. They don't think much about frustrated or anxious or stressed. And so we have an activity that we do that introduces kids to a new feeling vocabulary so that they can start to identify some nuances and feelings that they might not be thinking of usually. Once they've identified those, then we want to give them a tool that they can use to actually express their feelings in a way that is respectful to the other people that they're with. You know, sometimes you can express your feelings and leave somebody else feeling really bad.
Sure.
So we have an iMessage that we give them, and iMessages are something that, you know, you'll see in different formats, different ways. Ours is I feel, and they fill in the blank. They always begin with the person's name. We want to make sure that they're looking at somebody and that they really have identified and have the attention of the person that they're talking to. I feel when, and then they fill in the blank, and I want. And this is and we explain to kids that an iMessage is a tool that they can use to express their feelings, and it may or may not change the other person's behavior. That's an unintended benefit. If it happens, it's great. We call that a bonus. But an iMessage really is a way for them just to express their feelings and make sure that they're heard. going hand in hand with that is what we use as a rephrase, and we teach them that they use a rephrase to make sure that they understood what the other person was saying. Ours begins with, "Are you saying?" I've heard them, you know, with a lot of different phrasing, but ours begins with, "Are you saying?" A lot of times kids think that if the other person doesn't rephrase, that the iMessage didn't work. We also try to explain to kids that an iMessage can be used whether or not somebody is going to rephrase, and a rephrase can be used whether or not somebody else has used an iMessage. So if someone's coming at you and you want to maybe stop that momentum, you can start by saying, are you saying? And making sure you can begin a conversation with someone that way.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done iMessages, we do rephrases, and then we move into kind of our meat and potatoes, which is ready, set, go. And that's a step-by-step conflict resolution process that kids use. We train all of the kids to be able to use this. It's not like a peer mediation program. It's similar in some ways, but we want all of the kids to be able to use it so that at any point in their lives, whether they're in their classroom, whether at their home, in their neighborhood, if they're in a situation where someone's having a conflict, they can help them to step through the steps of Ready, Set, Go and solve it. You don't have to be the leader in the class. You don't have to be the kid who reads really well. Anyone can do it if they want to. So Ready, Set, Go takes a little bit of time, and the kids, the steps basically are you ready and willing to solve the problem peacefully? Once both people are ready and willing, then you can move on. We say, and then we set, the set section is what happened, how do you feel about it, and why does it matter? And then we ask them to rephrase the whole thing. What did that other person just say to you? Make sure you understand their point of view. We talk a lot about point of view and how important point of view is and how the other person's point of view is just as important as your point of view. You just need to make sure you both understand it. Then you can figure out how to solve the problem. And it's two simple questions. It's what do you want and what are you willing to do? And sometimes it takes going around and around a couple times before you can get to an agreement. But usually you're able to come up with an agreement that both people come away feeling good about. We call that a win-win solution.
Mm-hmm. Can you use, Tara, this model if you're encountering a situation that where there could be potential violence, where kids are about ready to have a fist fight with each other on the playground?
Well, what we will do, we have something else that we call I don't want to fight, which is something the kids can do to kind of extricate themselves from a potential physical confrontation. But this is something that we explain to kids. Sometimes in the heat of the moment, when you're about ready to come to blows, is not the time to pull out Ready, Set, Go. You want to take a break and then come back at it in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. As soon as people are calmed down, that very first question, you know, are you ready and willing to solve the problem peacefully, is huge. Because if both people can't honestly say yes, then the process doesn't work anyway.
Right.
So it's not something, you know, it does, we will hear from kids that they do use it on the playground, but it is something that they have to think, you know, you have to really be ready to solve the problem. You have to be willing to do that in order for it to work. You know, sometimes kids think that if they just say, okay, I'm not ready and willing to solve the problem, then they won't go through Ready, Set, Go, and someone else, you know, that's going to be a way for them to avoid it. The deal with that then is that somebody else is going to come in and solve the problem. You know, it'll be a teacher, it'll be some other adult, it'll be somebody who will impose some kind of quote-unquote solution to the problem. Well, it's not going to be one that either one of them is happy with. We tell kids all the time, you know, teachers can come in and end a situation, but they can't ever repair the relationship that you have with this person, no matter how intense, whether this is just somebody that you are an acquaintance with and you just have to deal with on a daily basis, or whether this is a really good friend. The teacher cannot solve that relationship, can't repair that. Only these two kids can do that together, and this is a tool in order for them to be able to do that. It's also, even if it's, you know, if a kid says, I'm not really invested in this relationship with this kid and I'm not going to spend a lot of time with this, well, okay, think about what the potential solution will be. 9 times out of 10, if two kids have been out of the playground and they've both gotten into a fight, the teacher, the first thing they're going to do is say, you know what, you both have lost your recess and you both have phone calls home. That I call a lose-lose solution. Nobody wins there. So kids really, when you explain that, they become invested in looking for those win-win solutions, something that they can both live with.
And it's a win-win for you if some of these techniques are brought back to the classroom. I would imagine that they're reinforced, and that happens in some instances.
Oh, it happens a lot. And that in the best instances, When you have a teacher who's really invested in this working, you'll go back into their classroom, and we go back into classrooms and do booster sessions afterwards, and you'll see a teacher who's got the Ready, Set, Go poster and the Fouls poster set up in the corner, and the kids are using Ready, Set, Go on a regular basis. And it takes some time. You know, I was a teacher, so I understand. It takes a little front-end time. They have to be willing to put a little, invest time in making sure that they're reinforcing iMessages and that they're using iMessages themselves. But once that groundwork is done, they've now gotten to the point where when kids come in and they've got a conflict on the playground, the teacher can not necessarily stop what they're doing to have to solve this. They can ask one of the other kids to come and take them over to the Ready, Set, Go corner and solve the and work with them to solve the problem. So it kind of takes it off of the teacher's burden. Now, we do always say to teachers and to kids, ultimately, if they can't come up with a solution on their own, ultimately the teacher is going to have to do it,
sure,
or the adult will have to do it. But again, it's in your best interest to solve it on your own if you can.
Yeah. You're using students who are in fourth and fifth grade, and you're expanding to middle school this year. Why did you pick that age group, and why are you expanding to middle school this year?
Well, initially, fourth and fifth graders were chosen because of developmentally, fourth and fifth graders are able to incorporate these new techniques. Their minds are pretty wide open to think about new things. And so it's an ideal age. They're able to process some more of the empathy and thinking about other people a little bit more easily than some younger students are. And yet they're not jaded quite as much. And there is a lot of role playing and a lot of kind of fun things that they do that they're not too old for yet. We have been asked, and we have been doing workshops for kids as old as, we've had kids as old as eighth grade come already using the current curriculum. And we are able to change it. You know, we adapt it to some extent. But we found that we were being asked to do that more and more, and that it was not as successful with the older kids because they have a little different perspective that they bring to workshops. And so what we're doing is we're working on a curriculum, which is about ready to go, that talks to middle school kids where they are and talks a little bit more about some of the problems that they have. We're talking with them about technology and cyberbullying, things that fourth and fifth graders aren't having to deal with quite as much. And so it's also a nice way to delve into some of the concepts that we talk to the fourth and fifth graders at a little deeper level. So ideally, if we've got a school that comes repeatedly, we can have their fourth graders come, and then we can have their fifth graders come again, because we have kind of a little bit of an adaption that we'll do if they've come a second time, and then they can follow up in sixth, seventh, or eighth grade and come a third time. So we've got almost a continuum of offerings that we have for anywhere from even as young as third, second, and third grade, all the way up to eighth grade.
You really would hope that those eighth graders you're seeing had been through the program in fourth or fifth grade, I'm sure.
I'd love it, but, you know, we'll take them wherever they come.
We welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. The executive director of Peace Learning Center of Milwaukee is our guest this part of the show, Tara Sarabin, and they're having their 10th anniversary. We have more information about that on our Facebook page if you'd like to go to that, the Kathleen Dunn Show. They have served thousands of children in the community, helping them learn nonviolent conflict resolution, healthy communication, and also an appreciation of the natural world, which we haven't talked about much. We'll get to that in a moment. But to be in a setting like that also makes it easier to be peaceful, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we start with some phone calls with Nancy in Arena. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A recent New York Times article detailed the issues that children from deeply disadvantaged homes bring with them to classrooms and social settings in their inability to control behavior due to a variety of social and biological issues, and they are pretty much lacking in impulse control. And I'm wondering how the programs that your speaker is discussing, if they work with kids who have these kinds of problems.
Absolutely. We have kids with impulse control problems at workshops all the time. In fact, teachers will often say, we'll get students many times in Milwaukee, some of the students who are labeled special ed will be in with a regular ed classroom. And so teachers will bring an entire group, which will be very heterogeneous. And at lunch, sometimes they'll say, now, can you tell who my identified special ed kids are? And 9 times out of 10, we can't, because what we're doing is so different than what they're doing at school. They're able to bring out a whole nother set of skills that they have within them that a traditional classroom setting doesn't necessarily bring out. And part of what we do, which I like to see as well, is that other kids are able to see, other kids and the teacher are able to see different facets of kids who have some troubling behavior in classroom and start to recognize some positive aspects of their personality. And just being able to recognize that sometimes can allow you to deal with somebody a little differently than you have traditionally. If you have, in your mind, you've labeled someone as a problem child or someone who's giving you issues, and you're able to see something a little different in them, you can foster that and you can rise that to the surface a little bit more often. And then once we've got kids using iMessages, using what I like to call a common language, they start to reinforce that with each other. And that is really huge, having just so you're identifying these positives and then you're reinforcing these positives, all of you together. It can be a really powerful tool. Mm.
Thank you, Nancy. Good question. Cindy in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask your guest about peer mediation. I wrote a master's thesis on peer mediation in schools where it was very positive, but people needed outside support like you provide. But also we're calling for a whole school approach where everyone in the school, starting with all the adults and then all the students, would also be trained in peer mediation. And it sounds somewhat similar to that.
Yeah, and that's my dream, actually. We've developed a couple of proposals for peace schools, we've called them. In which the teachers are trained, the staff, all the way down to the cooks, everyone is using the same language. And we would have in-services for parents as well so that they know what's going on. So far, I haven't found that wonderful grant from heaven to pay for that. But that is a direction that I would love to go in with
and
what we're doing.
And most of the students aren't pigeonholed as mediators. Everyone can be a mediator.
Exactly.
Everyone can participate in mediation.
Exactly. And that's a huge reason that we do what we do. We do have some schools will bring their peer mediators to us and they will be trained with us, but we really, really like them all to be trained. You know, we'll go back and meet with kids and they'll use Ready, Set, Go when they're babysitting or with their younger brother and sister. I mean, for us, it's ideal that everyone is trained. We're really all about getting the word out and spreading this as far as possible. We tell all the kids they're like a tiny little ripple and it moves beyond them. So if they...
That's wonderful.
Yeah, so their class, wonderful. Then their school, then their neighborhood, then their entire community.
Mm-hmm. Well, your work is wonderful.
Thank you.
Nice to hear about it.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks. Sue and Racine, hi.
Hello. I just really want to congratulate Tara on their 10 years. This is Sue Hallow,
Executive Director
of the Peace Learning Circles in Racine.
Our good friends.
The Peace Learning Center has mentored us so we could do this in Racine and Kenosha.
Oh,
yeah. Thanks for calling.
Oh, I'm so excited, and I'm so happy for all that you've done, Tara, and we're just really excited about your 10-year anniversary and are so grateful that you were there for us and continue to be there for us.
Well, and I should say, too, that if you happen to be down in the Racine area, Sue is a great person to contact as well. If you don't want to bring your kids all the way up to Milwaukee, take them down and visit Peace Learning Circles in Racine and Kenosha. It's a wonderful program as well.
Thank you, Sue. Is this all over the place now?
It's not. Don't I wish it were? You know, Sue just called in. She's working down in the Racine Kenosha area. Like I mentioned that we had a teacher who came to one of the conferences we did. I have done a couple of conferences, one in Madison, one in the Dells. And so some outstate teachers and counselors have been in. So we had a school counselor who came in from Bondiwell last year and really wanted to be trained. So she actually came down and was trained like our facilitators are and then took our curriculum back up to Bondiwell and did it with and is doing it with her students there. So slowly it's spreading. A couple of years ago, we had a school come from Mayville and spread it there as well. So we are always interested in spreading it out as much as we possibly can. We're hoping to be in Madison working with a congregation this spring. So it's an opportunity that if there are schools that are interested in learning to do this and they're too far away to bring their students, I'd be happy to talk to them.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. How do you know it works?
Well, we've done a lot of evaluation. We have evaluations that are done. The kids do a pre-survey before they come. They do a post-survey about 6 weeks after they've been to us. We have an impact survey that the teachers do. We have two surveys, actually, that the teachers do. And then we have something called a quickie slip that the kids do the day of. And I will tell you, and then a couple times we've had all of our evaluations evaluated by UWM's Center for Urban Research, and so they have independently evaluated them. But even on an ongoing basis, I'm collecting and looking at that material all the time. I will say that we're at about 91% of kids will say that they learned something at the Peace Learning Center that they actually will use when they
That's
leave.
Pretty high.
Yeah. And I'm also really proud of the fact that in this, all the surveys that I've seen and everything that I've seen, we've had only one teacher who has said they would not want to come back again.
Hmm.
So we're at about 99.999%.
Can't ask for anything more. Tara, thank you very much. Have a nice time on Sunday.
Thanks.
We have information on our Facebook page about their event celebrating 10 years. It's Sunday 3 to 5 at the Friends Meeting House in Milwaukee. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produce this program. Thanks to Tara Serbin, who is the Executive Director of Peace Learning Center of Milwaukee, for being with us. We'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political, starting at 9. Great conversations ahead all day long. Thanks for listening to this one on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.